Hi, I'm bracing against this 30 mile an hour wind. If you listen to the podcast and can't see, we're barely surviving here. This 30 mile an hour winds from Hurricane Ian hit the Midlands. Also, my phone mic doesn't have a condom, but I guess if you know how many kids I've got, that's not a surprise. But a lot to report if we survive this storm. We've got Rockstar Cheer updates. We've got the latest on the Murdoch murders, crime and corruption saga. We've got a political update about a candidate licking a hallucinogenic cactus. If we survive, we'll tell you all those stories and much more on a blustery edition of your Week in Review. All right, so we're back safe inside from our brush with death and the 30 mile an hour winds outside, and all the microphones here also raw dogging it, I guess is how we say it. That's right, babe. But I wanted to start this week with a segment about the marketplace of ideas, because if you follow this news outlet, if you're a regular member of our audience, you know that one of the things that I'm committed to above everything else is a belief in the marketplace of ideas and the free exchange of thoughts, perspectives. And so this week we saw one of the interesting sides of that dynamic, because again, I don't have a monopoly on the truth. You don't have a monopoly on the truth. We fumble toward it together. That's what we're here for, to host that conversation. But sometimes that conversation needs to be blunt, and people who participate in it dishonestly or disingenuously need to be called out. And that happened this week because I published a story last week. In fact, we talked about it on Fitz News. We did a couple videos on it, detailing a judge in Charleston, South Carolina by the name of Bentley Price. Now, this judge has a history of letting violent criminals go. But this particular case, the one we focused on in our column last week, was especially egregious. It involved a serial abuser of women, multiple convictions on his record, who was on parole, multiple new charges, including one in which he literally stomped a defenseless woman in the head, after punching her repeatedly in the face while grabbing her hair. This woman suffered multiple lacerations, serious injuries as part of that attack. But this guy was facing all these charges, multiple charges. Price let him walk. And he let him walk even though prosecutors and victims had argued for a sentence of anywhere between 6 to 10 years. By the way, the high end of the sentence that Price could have doled out, 14 years in prison. That was the high end. Prosecutors asked for at least 6, so less than half, of which he would have served 85% of that time in South Carolina. You get time off for good behavior. But Price let him walk, suspended the sentence, despite his prior history and despite the savagery of the attack. Actually, multiple attacks. That was just the worst of the bunch. So I wrote a column calling this judge out as part of South Carolina's ongoing injustice system, its ongoing judicial leniency. And I also called out, as I am wont to do, the state lawmakers who appoint the judges. And it wasn't long before one of those lawmakers, a Leon Stavronakis out of Charleston, South Carolina, the diminutive Leon Stavronakis, known by his colleagues as Short Stack due to that diminutive stature, he decided to pop off on social media. And again, I love this because, again, the criticism and the feedback, got to have it, need it. I've got to be held accountable too. So he called my attack, and I quote, total bullshit, right? And stuck up for this judge and basically said, you know, as a blogger just spewing, you know, innuendo, and that calling this judge corrupt, that I was out of line. Well, okay, that's fair. That's a fair criticism. Or at least it would have been coming from anybody other than Leon Stavronakis. Because here's one of the things we found out in covering this case. It turns out that Stavronakis has quite the cozy relationship with this judge, who, by the way, he and his colleagues appointed to his position and are keeping in his position. Right? There again, lawmakers are in charge. They pick the judges. Not only that, they screen who gets to run for judge. So they literally rig the game before it's even afoot. But what we found was that Leon Stavronakis, in the last 2 to 3 years, had several bond revocation hearings before Judge Price. And again, a bond revocation here is where prosecutors come to the judge and say, hey, this violent criminal has violated the terms of their bond. You need to lock them up. Because again, in South Carolina, when these violent criminals get bond and are let back on the streets, there's literally no consequence when they violate bond. We saw that extensively in our coverage of the Bowen Turner case. If you recall that story out of Orangeburg, South Carolina. Well, it turns out the state was 0-for-6 in its recent bond revocation requests against clients of Leon Stavronakis, including another client, by the way, who was accused of domestic violence of a high and aggravated nature, which is the most serious domestic violence charge on the books in South Carolina. So apparently something with this attorney, this lawyer, legislator, and this judge. But not only did Judge Price rule against the state and rule for Stavronakis in all of these cases, but there was one case where he actually even reduced the bond. So the state goes to him saying, hey, this guy's in violation. You got to revoke him. Not only did he not revoke him, he actually lowered his bond amount. So it's unbelievable. And folks, that to me is the definition of this corrupt relationship, which is why I thought it was incredibly ironic that it was Leon Stavronakis who decided to take that shot, decided to stand up for this system, which he perpetuates with his votes, which he and his colleagues continue to enable by electing judges like Bentley Price. So I guess here's the moral of the story. You know, F around, find out, right? Play stupid games, win stupid prizes, right? But the question isn't what Leon Stavronakis is going to do moving forward, because he apparently, after we called him out, drank a very sizable cup of STFU. I've got some nice coffee here. I'm going to have a sip of my coffee, but man, that's good coffee. I don't want to know what that cup of STFU that Representative Stavronakis is drinking from this morning tastes like. Because I bet it tastes a lot like the BS that's been coming out of his mouth in relation to the story. But anyway, he doesn't matter. And the other little backbenchers that came to his defense, like State Representative Micah Caskey out of West Columbia, they don't matter. Again, they're backbenchers. They do what they're told, clearly. But what matters is what the leaders in the South Carolina General Assembly do in response to this ongoing epidemic of leniency, of unconscionable conduct by these judges in South Carolina, unconscionable neglect of their obligation to public safety and to victims. What are they going to do about it? And I'm talking about Merle Smith, the Speaker of the House. I'm talking about Thomas Alexander, the President of the Senate. I'm talking about Luke Rankin, the Chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I'm talking about Chris Murphy, the Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Of course, we know what he's going to do. He tried to get his wife appointed to the state Supreme Court, right? That's how he does it. Again, this is what happens when lawmakers are in control of this. You have a judicial branch that's completely under their thumb. It is literally an annex of the judicial, of the legislature. We need an independent judiciary in South Carolina, people, and that is never going to happen, ever, unless we get lawmakers out of the business of appointing their cronies to judgeships. Now, I want to tell you one thing. We're going to have somebody in the studio next week who's going to bring a counterpoint to this. And unluckily for me, she's a hell of a lot smarter than Leon Stavronakis and this other Micah Caskey put together. In fact, that's insulting to her. She's 10 times smarter than either of these idiots. But I'm looking forward to that conversation because, folks, we are committed to that marketplace of ideas on this issue, on any issue. But if you're going to come, you better bring your A game. Because we do push back. All right, so for weeks we've been calling it the Rockstar Cheer Scandal, but this week that name changed because the Rockstar Cheer Scandal officially became the Cheer Incorporated Scandal, people. And the reason is a major escalation in an epidemic of sex abuse within the cheerleading industry, as documented in a new federal lawsuit that was filed this week in Memphis, Tennessee. Now, this case marked a significant ramping up of the stakes in this story that Fitz News exclusively reported on last month and has been continuing to drive over the last few weeks. But this lawsuit had a new angle to it. Again, we already knew many of the defendants in this case, and I'm talking about Varsity, which is the behemoth in this industry, the 400-pound gorilla, dominates both the for-profit side of cheerleading, but also the regulatory side. So varsity, one of the targets of both the lawsuit in South Carolina and the new lawsuit in Tennessee. Then we've also got the USASF, USA Cheer, two of these ostensibly independent oversight entities, which are supposed to be protecting the athletes in this industry, child athletes, many of them. Those entities, part of it. Then you've got the corporate owners. I'm talking about Charles Bank. I'm talking about Bain Capital, the company founded by Mitt Romney, which purchased Varsity back in 2018 for nearly $3 billion. They're linked to this. But the Tennessee case is interesting because what you saw for the first time, at least according to the attorneys who filed it, was a direct line of culpability, of responsibility from the gym where alleged abuse occurred and Varsity, which is, again, that 400-pound gorilla, that industry giant. And if you listen to Cheer Incorporated, our podcast, this past week, you know a little bit about the history of Varsity, about how it came to be, about how it came to dominate this industry, about how it came to control those ostensibly independent oversight agencies. In fact, Jen Wood, our researcher, did amazing work on this latest episode of Cheer Inc., diving into that very evolution of Varsity as just the ultimate arbiter in the cheer world. But now we are beginning to see layers peeled back from that. We're beginning to see what's inside this industry. And folks, it is insidious. And we're not just talking about these graphic, depraved actions of adults sending unspeakable images, videos to children, of forcing these children to perform sex acts on them. We're not just talking about that. We're talking about the culture that covered it up, which to me is every bit as big of a story. But the Tennessee lawsuit, again, a major escalation because the gym involved, Premier Athletics, based out of Knoxville, according to the lawsuit, directly owned by Varsity. Now, that was disputed by Premier, which issued a lengthy statement, one of many denials issued in response to this lawsuit, just like the round of denials that followed from the South Carolina lawsuit. They claimed that wasn't true. They claimed that they were only recently purchased and that some of these allegations had nothing to do with them, allegedly, but even though it's their gym owner, which are accused of facilitating this conduct. Now, one of the individuals involved in this new case, Dominic Frizzell, 22-year-old cheerleader for the University of Tennessee, or at least he was a cheerleader until this story came out. Frizzell terminated from the UT Spirit program in the aftermath of this lawsuit being filed in Memphis this past week. That leads to another question. What did the University of Tennessee know? When did they know it? That's what Bakari Sellers, one of the attorneys in this lawsuit, asked. And we're going to try to find out the answer to that question as well as we continue our investigation into this story. But we've now got two cases, not only alleging graphic acts by individuals associated with gyms, and all this again started with Scott Foster in Greenville, South Carolina, but both of these cases allege a conspiracy, an actual RICO conspiracy, in which the gyms, the coaches, were enabled and facilitated, allegedly, by these industry titans, by these oversight groups, and by these for-profit entities who conspired to cover this scandal up in an effort to continue driving profits into their back pockets. And again, with $3 billion on the line, as Jen Wood said in our podcast, folks, we're talking about a lot of money. Now, we covered the story extensively. We also covered the responses from those who have been accused. But I think most importantly, we heard from those who are the victims of this story and their family members. This news outlet earlier published the very first column from a Jane Doe in the South Carolina lawsuit, wrote on our pages, shared her perspective on what happened. And this week, our director of special projects, Dylan Nolan, did a story on another victim of this, a family member of another one of the South Carolina victims. And I wanted to bring Dylan on the set real quick to talk about his story and that perspective that was shared with our news outlet. All right, so as promised, our director of special projects, Dylan Nolan, stepping out from behind the cameras to join me. In addition to his work here at Fitz, Dylan is also the producer of Cheer Incorporated, the podcast. Dylan, thanks for coming on with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. And it was great to have that conversation with Mother Doe, as we termed her, earlier this week. What was very interesting to me about that conversation was the fact that she did everything right. She did everything by the book. And this is something that Jennifer and I had talked about after our discussion. And yet, one, the culture at the gym was such that despite her working there, which was the craziest part of this interview, she worked there as a second job so that she could, one, be around her kids, and two, fund them going to cheer. And yet, they still chose to prey on her children right under her nose. And two, once she discovered that her children were being allegedly sexually abused at this gym, she attempted to bring it to multiple groups of authorities and saw nothing happen. And even scarier than that, I think, was the fact that she raised the issue with the parents at the gym, the other parents who, I mean, you have children. If somebody told you that your kids were going to a daycare, a gym, a karate studio, and that the coaches were getting sexually inappropriate, that would obviously raise some red flags. But she said that a lot of the parents quickly jumped to defending these coaches. So it speaks to a unique culture that existed at this gym. And as this lawsuit balloons, I think multiple gyms across the country, that we really didn't have insight into in the days right after Scott Foster's suicide. We knew there were allegations, but now we're kind of starting to see the culture.
As more Mother Does, Jane Does, John Does come forward, Dylan, tell us, obviously that culture of secrecy is one of the narratives. Are there any other narratives that you see emerging in this Cheer Incorporated scandal?
I think it's going to be very interesting to hear more from people who are inside the gyms. I think it's going to be very interesting to get a personal look at how this could have happened, because I think it's hard for us to understand from the outside how systemically this was allowed to happen. And I think that that's the same question that got asked, I mean, when the Catholic Church was having the walls come down on its sexual abuse scandal, the same questions were asked. How did all of these people know for years and nothing happened? The same questions were asked when Harvey Weinstein went down. I mean, the whole film industry knew that he was a pervert, and yet it took the straw that broke the camel's back for him to eventually come crashing down. So I think there are going to be those same types of questions asked in these scenarios. But as you wrote, I think last week, everyone's story is different. Every parent, every victim, and everybody who was at those gyms who wasn't affected by this, but maybe knows somebody who is, they all have a different perspective on this and how this happened. So we're happy to give a platform to those voices, obviously.
No, absolutely. And again, we talked in our first segment about that open microphone. I can't think of a story where having that kind of an open microphone policy is more important than this one.
Right. We do our work as reporters. We dig in on the facts, on the corporate structure. We give people somebody they can trust to talk to. But at the end of the day, it's the voices of the people who were actually there, actually affected by the situation, that matter the most in this scenario.
Absolutely. Well put. Dylan Nolan, our director of special projects, the executive producer of Cheer Inc., our podcast, which reminds me, if you haven't checked it out yet, go to Apple, go to Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Listen to it, download it, and if you like it, review it and share it with your friends, folks. We'll be back for more on the Fitz News Week in Review. So we had another big week in the Murdaugh murders, crime, and corruption saga. I know it's bumped to our C block here today, but that doesn't mean it wasn't a busy week, and that doesn't mean the developments in the case weren't significant. I want to start on the criminal side with the federal case against Russell Lafitte, the banker from Palmetto State Bank, who was one of Alec Murdaugh's alleged co-conspirators. Lafitte has been charged at the state level along with Murdaugh for fleecing a number of Alec Murdaugh's former clients at the law firm PMPED, which was dominated by the Murdaugh family for years. Murdaugh's father, former 14th Circuit Solicitor Randolph Murdaugh III, was an attorney there. His brother, Randy Murdaugh, still an attorney at the newly named Parker Law Firm, is what they call themselves now. But the fleecing of these clients has been a central component of the financial crimes case against Alec Murdaugh. And he's currently accused of over 90 financial crimes, could face decades behind bars. And this is significant because, as I've previously pointed out, prosecutors in the murder trial against Alec Murdaugh, they're kind of playing with house money. They know they've got all these financial charges against Alex Murdaugh that they can prove, that they've got extensive documentation on. So they know they can lock them up for a long time on those charges, which makes it a little easier, or reduces some of the pressure in that murder trial. But Russell Lafitte, charged at the state level for allegedly co-conspiring with Alec Murdoch, he is the only person so far to be charged federally in connection with that case. And this week, folks, that federal case erupted in the headlines. We've been seeing it for the last couple weeks, some back and forth between federal prosecutors and attorneys for Russell Lafitte. But that escalated significantly this week with the filing of a motion by Lafitte's attorneys asking the feds to basically show their hand. And this is an interesting development because in that motion, it was insinuated that federal prosecutors are relying on certain witnesses who themselves are guilty of criminal conduct. Now, this isn't surprising. Feds, state prosecutors will use folks all the time who have participated in scams and say, hey, you help us out against these top targets, we'll cut you a deal. It's, it happens all the time. It's not groundbreaking, earth-shattering, or anything of that nature. But in this case, with so much attention and with so much potential criminal activity, again, we don't know the whole dimensions of this corruption saga yet, folks. We just know what's been released so far by prosecutors based on the ongoing investigations. But these investigations are ongoing, just like that investigation into the double homicide allegedly committed by Alec Murdoch, which blew this case up into the international audience. But as this federal case has unfolded, as we started digging into this federal motion this week, one of the things our sources told us that was incredibly interesting was that the feds are allegedly relying on an attorney at the Murdoch Law Firm, as well as another employee at the Murdoch Law Firm, to make their case against Russell Lafitte. Now, according to Lafitte's filing, he wants to know who is dropping the dime on him. And the reason he wants to know is because, according to that filing, it is strongly implied that Lafitte believes whoever is ratting him out is guilty of crimes every bit as bad, potentially worse, than the crimes he committed. And again, those alleged accomplices are an attorney and a staffer at the Murdoch Law Firm. Now, I've spoken with sources close to the firm, the former PMPED firm, which is now called Parker Law. They tell me that there's absolutely no truth to this, that nobody else at the Murdoch Law Firm knew anything about Alec Murdoch's financial scams. They claim that all they saw were checks going out to Palmetto State Bank and to Forge Consulting, which was this company Murdoch created to sort of mimic an existing company. They claim that all of this took them completely by surprise. Now, that's been a dubious declaration from the beginning, and I've said so. But again, just want to make sure all voices are heard on this. That's what's coming from sources close to the law firm. But if there are other PMPED attorneys involved, this would mark a major escalation of the financial crime saga. But guess what, folks? It wasn't the only one. Because Lafitte also pointed to an escalation on his side of the equation at Palmetto State Bank. Specifically, he pointed to an executive committee, which according to him, authorized all of his financial decisions. And guess what, folks? Two of his family members are on that committee. So yes, that sound you hear, that beep, 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 that Russell Lafitte literally backing that bus up over his own family, folks. I guess when you're in that kind of jam, do what you got to do. I don't know. But seriously, throwing his own family under the bus and then beep, beep, backing on up over him. But this, again, is another potential major escalation of this scandal, because you've got the allegation of folks beyond Alec Murdoch at the law firm who knew about this and may have participated in it, if you believe this filing. And then you've got other folks at the bank who allegedly knew about it, signed off on it. So again, potentially significant developments here. Now, as I pointed out in my coverage of this week, if you read the articles on Fitz News, I made it very clear there is a very strong chance that this is just Russell Lafitte trying to throw something out there to see if it sticks, that he knows he's caught, he knows he's in trouble, trying to pull as many people into this problem as he possibly can. Very strong possibility there, so we can't rule that out. But, every indication that we have seen from the beginning of this scandal points to the fact that there is not no way, but that it's highly unlikely that Alec Murdoch was able to pull all of this off by himself without anyone knowing. Now, did he benefit from secrecy? Did he benefit from the fact that while his powerful father was still alive, not a lot of people would question what he was up to? Yes, that's a distinct possibility. But we've got to look at the allegations that were raised in the federal case this week, folks. We've got to at least consider that, hey, maybe there's something to what Russell Lafitte has publicly said in his deposition. By the way, we reported some exclusive excerpts from that deposition where he alluded to this expanded group of people who knew about the shady financial activity that literally took advantage of some of the most vulnerable people, people with disabilities, folks, robbing them. Totally out of line, totally unacceptable, and that's why these folks are in the mess that they're in now, is because they took from these people, and they did it with impunity, and they did it repeatedly. But as that federal case ramps up, folks, this is definitely something to keep an eye on, because it could mark a major escalation in the financial crimes component of this case. Now, this wasn't the only Murdoch news that broke this week. There was a surprising development in the civil case. As we reported 2 weeks ago, South Carolina Circuit Court Judge Daniel Hall issued a very controversial ruling in the wrongful death case that was brought by Mallory Beach. She's, again, the 19-year-old teen who was killed in a February 2019 boat crash when Paul Murdoch, the late Paul Murdoch, allegedly driving that boat, severely inebriated at the time of the crash, if you believe the charges that were filed against him by the Office of the South Carolina Attorney General. But Beach perished. Her family has filed a lawsuit against those it believes responsible, including multiple members of the Murdoch family, including Alec Murdoch, including Buster Murdoch, whose identification Paul allegedly used to purchase alcohol from a Parker's gasoline station. Parker's convenience stores, they're also listed in that suit, as is their founder, Greg Parker, who, by the way, has been engaged in a jihad to try to demonize the Murdochs to get his company and get himself off the hook here. Been fascinating to watch that development. But Judge Hall decided earlier this month he was going to split those two defendants, the Murdochs and the Parkers, and proceed with two separate trials, two separate wrongful death trials. Now, this was objected to strenuously by the Beach family and their attorney, Mark Tinsley, who said that he didn't want the family reliving the trauma of what happened to their daughter twice. And in addition to that, Tinsley pointed out that the first trial would set the bar for damages, and basically, whoever was trying the second trial might get off the hook. And he pointed that out to Judge Hall and asked him to reconsider that ruling. In fact, not only did he ask Judge Hall to reconsider, he told the judge, if you don't, I'm going to be forced to appeal this case. Well, surprisingly, Judge Hall did just that. And not only did he reconsider, not only did he grant Mark Tinsley's motion to reconsider, he reversed his decision. Again, incredibly shocking development. You never see this happen in South Carolina's justice system. Never see this happen. Judge completely flip-flopped the decision and said, you are correct, Attorney Tinsley. One case, moving forward. And guess what? That case has been scheduled for January 9, 2023, which, as of this writing, is right around the time that both prosecutors and defense attorneys believe that the Murdoch murder trial will be held. So, going to be a crazy month of January, people, on both the criminal and the civil side of the Murdoch murders, crime, and corruption saga. But Fitz News was at the tip of the spear on all these stories this week, counting us to continue to drive this story moving forward as we follow this Lowcountry saga to its conclusion. All right, so is Fitz News a political website, or is it a reality television website? Some days I don't know. In fact, since Thomas Ravenel, you know, who the hell knows? But the latest reality TV star to land on our pages is none other than Ron Rawlis, the Greenville developer whose estranged wife, Paula Dyer, is the alleged mistress of Congressman William Timmons. This scandal blew up earlier this year. Rawlis has continued to drive it via his Instagram account. And actually, let's take a look. He's still driving it. Let's watch.
Hey, Greenville News, you're straight trash. Fucking garbage. You guys want to write some no-nonsense gossip column about me today and this nasty-ass property that nobody cared about until I showed up to the scene? I mean, come on. Let's be real. You don't have the stomach to write one thing about any of the real shit that is important. Not one thing have you written about William Timmons or the abuse of power or the injustice in the criminal system or the family court system, or the, I mean, come on, this is dumb. This is dumb. Do I have to do everything? I mean, if you guys want your news, you just got to get it from Fitz News, because Greenville News is freaking all scared. They're scared. They're scared or paid off, one of the two. That's all there is to it. But Daddy's not.
I believe it or not, this is the best thing to happen to the Greenville News in months, because folks, I thought the paper disappeared. I mean, literally, people are talking about the Greenville News. This is like the best thing that could have happened to that paper. Again, disappeared. You know, you got the state kind of on the down swing. You've got the Charleston Post and Courier kind of dominating the market. Greenville News has literally vanished. So congrats, Greenville News. People know you are around. They know you exist. Anyway, the Ron Ross saga is going to continue to generate attention, because guess what, folks? The guy he's fired up against, William Timmons, according to my sources, is the focus of a preliminary inquiry by the U.S. House Ethics Committee, an inquiry that could very soon turn into a full-fledged formal investigation. What are they looking into? According to my sources, additional allegations of inappropriate sexual activity on the part of U.S. Congressman William Timmons, who represents the 4th District in South Carolina, Greenville, and Spartanburg. Count on Fitz News to keep tabs on that scandal. Now, I want to switch gears here. We're going to talk about another politician who's had some rumors thrown about him and his personal life. I'm not going to get into that. Nothing criminal alleged, nothing, you know. And there's no Ron Rollis driving this guy's drama, but I'm talking about Joe Cunningham, the candidate for governor of South Carolina, the Democratic nominee for governor, who has based his campaign on, number one, pissing off black people, and number two, pissing off old people, which makes you wonder, what kind of campaign advice is this guy getting? But anyway, Joe Cunningham announced this week in an interview with, wait for it, the Greenville News. Man, it's a banner week for this publication, people, a banner week. But he told the Greenville News during a rally attended by a whopping 75 people. It's impressive, guys. 75 people, that his campaign had pulled into a tie with Governor Henry McMaster. A tie. Okay, now I'm going to pull this graphic up real quick. This is the website 538. No friend to the right, no friend to Republicans, no friend to conservatives. They ran this race 100 times, people. Cunningham won twice. And in one of those, he won by literally 0.1%. Okay. Now, do I really have to spin this? Do I really have to counter this spin? No, folks. This race is not close. Henry McMaster is going to win. And that's, for me, disappointing, because McMaster has been an absolutely atrocious governor. He's proposed massive spending increases. He has approved the biggest tax hike in South Carolina history, did that 4 years ago. He has proposed anemic income tax relief. I mean, the guy's pure status quo. And in fact, at a time when gas prices were surging across the country and governors in other states cut their gas taxes, guess what? South Carolina raised them. And Henry McMaster went and hammed it up with a giant beaver in Florence. For real. For real. A giant beaver. The guy is a giant beaver as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, back to Cunningham. Here's the deal, folks. As much as I wish we had a competitive election in South Carolina, we don't. We don't. McMaster's going to win this race in a walk. And that's unfortunate, because guess what? We need a discussion of ideas. We need accountability over folks who put their name up for election. That discussion matters. And if we don't have it, and if there isn't pressure for these elected officials in the Republican Party, we're going to continue to see the kind of government we get in South Carolina. Which, by the way, just this past week, I did a story on it on Fitz News, the worst labor participation rate in South Carolina's history, all the way down to 57%. Fifth worst rate in the entire country, folks. Our workforce is shrinking. It's shrinking. And no one's talking about it, because the two people running for governor are complete idiots. Literal frat boys. Old frat boy, young frat boy. But anyway, whatever I think of these candidates, whatever you think of these candidates, whatever the mainstream media, which clearly wants a competitive election, whatever they think, it doesn't matter, because the numbers are what they are. Henry McMaster is going to win this race by 6 to 8 percentage points. Mark it down, write it down, take a picture. That's what's going to happen. But again, if you follow this site, count on that kind of bluntness. Don't count on this crap from the mainstream press about, oh, it's going to be a close race. It's pulled even. No, it isn't. No, it hasn't. The only way you think that this race is pulled even, folks, is if you're licking some of that cactus that Joe Cunningham's Lieutenant Governor Tally Casey's been licking. Unless you're high on mescaline right now, folks, this is not a close race. But again, count on Fist News to bring you all the latest on South Carolina politics, regardless. All right, that's a wrap for this week's editions of the Week in Review. Now that I pissed off everybody on the Republican and the Democratic side of the aisle here in South Carolina, but that's why we're here. And if you want the same crap that you always get from the same outlets you always listen to, by all means, go to the mainstream media, see what they've got for you. If you want to hear the truth, irrespective of whether it hurts your feelings, keep it here on Fist News and your Week in Review.